Coming up on this week's show, forget the Apple Watch, bring on the Sega Watch.
Some big Atari 50 updates.
And we chat development from the Apple II to the Nintendo DS with Ed Magnin.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every single Friday with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, if you're thinking of Christmas presents for yourself, have you seen Go Straight, the ultimate guide to side-scrolling beat-em-ups, celebrating the history of that incredible genre going back over 40 years of bare-knuckle street fighting action? So if you're a fan of beat-em-up games, you need to check it out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 407, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for our weekly look at what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology. And of course, chatting to a veteran of the industry in the second half of the podcast. And it's actually quite nice today to sit down. I've got my big Christmas cozy jumper on at the moment. Got the heating on in this room as well. Nice to have a break from just going out Christmas shopping and Christmas parties and all that that goes on this time of year.
And you guys are sounding like you're both dying as well.
Well, it was my birthday yesterday, so I've had this rotten cold. I'm sure you gave it to me virtually, Joe, down this Zoom or whatever.
Just coughing down the mic.
That's it.
What software have you been using?
Yeah, I haven't got my antivirus software needs updating, I think. But yeah, so we went out because it's my birthday for a few drinks, first ones in a while, and I'm kind of paying the price a bit today. Don't drink if you've got the man flu, I think, is the lesson learned there, which I'm sure I will not adhere to over the next few weeks. But I mean, it is great. I mean, this is actually our final normal show of the year, isn't it? Because our Christmas specials are coming up next couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's the one time of the year that we actually get a week off, which is amazing, and that's usually over the New Year's period. But first we have our Christmas specials, which we've actually pre-recorded, but you know,
spoilers.
You guys are going to find it really exciting because we're doing our Christmas quiz.
Yeah.
And I'm hosting this time, which I guarantee chaos on the Christmas quiz.
Yeah, I haven't started editing it yet, but I'm giving myself at least a week to do that.
Yeah, so, good luck.
Let's talk a bit more about the quiz this year as well then, because, I mean, this is in our Retro Hour tradition. This will be our seventh one that we worked out where, you know, we basically just have a bit of a giggle, ask a load of questions, get a few teams together. We've all got secret weapons this year as well. And this was, I think it's the first time you and I, Joe, have actually been rivals in the quiz.
Yeah, because you're always either Quizmaster or on my team.
You kicked me off this time, though, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I didn't kick you off. You brought the your secret weapon on. You brought Slopes on.
Yeah.
From Slopes Game Room, DJ Slopes, who I was about to say something then, but I don't want to spoil it. But yeah, you brought the Oracle on. And, you know, like special guests, obviously we had Paul and Ollie on.
Yeah, Paul from Retro Gamer Magazine and Ollie as well, who does a huge video game quiz.
Yeah, and then I brought my mate Jason on from down the street. So Jason's one of my best friends who's a massive, massive, massive retro gamer enthusiast as well. And, you know, who I go and do the cons with and, you know, sell games and stuff. He's the guy who's got the almost complete PAL Mega Drive collection. But spoilers, there was about four Mega Drive questions in the whole thing.
Yeah, so. I tried to tune the questions up this year as well. So hopefully, you know, the audience will find it as enjoyable as we do. And it's always a good laugh, isn't it? It's kind of like the pressure's off and you're just kind of doing a quiz, even though you guys take it so seriously that the pressure ramps up for the host. Yeah.
So you'll find out in the next couple of weeks who's going to be crowned the Retro Hour Super Quiz Champion of 2023. And of course, you can play along at home as well. That's coming out 2 weeks today. But next week, we're going to be doing our look back on the year as well, because I think, you know, 2023 has been a really interesting year, not only in retro tech and gaming, but also the amount of guests we've had on this podcast and the variety as well. So we're going to be doing our special look back episode next week, and then the Christmas quiz will land on the Friday before Christmas. But before that, we have got a normal show to talk about this week, and I'm going to be bringing up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology in a moment, and an incredible interview that you've done this week, Ravi.
Yeah, so I chatted with Ed Magnin, and Ed is such an awesome developer. You know, he's been kind of working from 1979, and he's developed all the way to present day. Some of his stuff is really interesting. So he's worked for companies like Cinemaware, MicroProse, Virgin Games as well, all huge companies. And he kind of specializes in hardware and, you know, programming and the porting. He ran this amazing, it was kind of an online service, but, you know, back in the days, back in 1979, and it was called Telephone Software Connection.
That's crazy, Ellie.
You know, people would be downloading from this system and also doing credit card payments back then. This was all done on early Apple machines. So a lot of Ed's kind of work in the early days was on the Apple and Apple II, porting cinema games like, you know, Rocket Ranger, Three Stooges as well. So having that kind of cinemaware style going from, you know, the Amiga that they developed it onto, then into the Apple IIgs, and then later he was working at MicroProse on titles like Pirates as well, which is a huge one. And also then he moved on to Virgin Games, moving on to the Game Boy, Nintendo Entertainment System as well, but doing really good ports like Prince of Persia, which was just a fabulous port for the Game Boy. And then later on, he went on to Game Boy Advance and Game Boy Color. And we talk about, you know, the differences of working with Nintendo, their approval process, and how that differed from, you know, working with Apple and on the Apple II titles.
Yeah, Nintendo's a process very different to home micros, isn't it? And I love the fact you mentioned then that he was taking online credit card payments in the late 70s. I don't think my mum trusted putting her bank card information into a website until about 2 years ago.
Oh, he's very pioneering with the stuff that he did. He even developed an app recently, which is one of the funniest apps I've heard about, which you can play background sounds. So you can pretend that you're like on an airplane or in a hospital or something when you're ringing at work with an excuse. It's called Calling Sick. And I thought that was a genius idea as well.
So looking forward to this one. Our special guest, Ed Magnin. He's coming up on the show in around 35 minutes from now. But before we do that, we, of course, bring you up to speed on what's been happening. Another busy week in the world of retro, including some very big updates for the wonderful Atari 50 collection. Now, I don't think you guys have played the Atari 50 collection yet, have you?
No. This is going to sound so strange. Like, I wanted to get it. I probably will get it because I think it's only about 25 quid now. Yeah. But I was disappointed that there's only a handful of Jaguar games on there.
Is that why you wanted it, for the Jaguar?
Wanted it for more Jaguar games. Like, I think I would have been all over it if Alien vs. Predator was on there. But I think you get Atari carts and a couple of others. But you get loads of 2600 games and 5200 games and stuff like that, which, as we've said before, is probably a little bit before most of our times, to be honest. But it is the gift that keeps on giving. And you have said to me, Dan, that the presentation on Atari 50 is fantastic.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's obviously from Digital Eclipse, who I believe Atari actually bought them, didn't they, a while back? So they're part of Atari now. But yeah, I mean, really what it is, I mean, the reason I wanted it, and I actually got it for Christmas last year, actually, is because it's really more like a documentary as well. Mm. And, you know, it's more like preserving the artwork and the stories behind the games. So really, it's kind of like an interactive documentary. You hear some of the developers talking about the development process, and then you can play the game itself. So the big news is, though, that obviously this came out around a year ago now, but this week Digital Eclipse have added 12 more classic Atari games as a free holiday content update pack, which I didn't see this one coming. I thought, you know, it's incredible that they're basically a year later just pumping out free content for it. You know, it's not payable DLC or anything like that.
Yeah, no, it's really cool that, and you know, the majority of them are 2600 games again.
Yeah.
But, you know, completely free. You don't have to pay for it or anything like that. It's out now as well. Like, you know, it wasn't like, oh, it's coming next week or anything. They just announced it's out. It's there. The update is here, kind of thing.
It's good to see, because I've seen, like, you know, a lot of these old releases of like Atari classic packs and stuff like that come out for systems and then kind of just be left and not updated. And having this whole like holiday content update is quite welcome.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I won't spend too long on the games list. You know, you can obviously find it, you know, if you've got the update, you'll know. If not, you can Google it pretty quickly. But yeah, there's a couple of homebrew ones on there. You've got Adventure 2 for the 2600. There's one called Aquaventure as well, which is a prototype. Save Mary, which is another prototype. And these are prototypes that, you know, have been, I think, kind of circulating on the web for a while, but it's nice to have them in a, you know, somewhat official package. And then you've got a bunch of other 2600 games. And there is one Atari Lynx game as well called Warbirds. So I do think it's a very nice update. And you mentioned then, Joe, about, you know, you like more Jaguar content on there. They have said, though, this is not all. They are going to be releasing more regular updates for it as well.
Okay.
As we go forward. So it looks like, you know, definitely is worth, you know, you pay once and you're getting a load of games as they can make them available, which I think is very really cool. So when that's available now.
Atari seem to be doing, like, you know, some really cool stuff recently. And hopefully next year we're going to have maybe somebody from Atari.
Yeah, which I think it's about time we spoke to someone from. Yeah, because I think you're right. The direction the company's going in now does seem, you know, like really clued up now, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, attracting retro fans. So yeah, watch this space. And that update is available now. And speaking of Atari, actually, something else from the Atari stable, because this is our mates at Night Dive Studios. And you may have seen this. I've been watching a few YouTube reviews of this. I've not played it or bought it myself just yet, but definitely one on the maybe contender list, you know, for games that I might download over the Christmas break. Turok 3 has had a rather nice looking remaster.
Yeah, so like you say, from Night Dive Studios and Atari, released earlier this week on PC, PlayStation, Xbox and Switch, which is cool and makes sense because of it was an N64 game, a really late N64 game, came out in 2000. I think the GameCube was 2001, so pretty late into the N64's lifespan. I was a big fan of Turok, but I never played number 3. I had number 1 and 2 and played them to death, and I had Rage Wars as well, which was like the deathmatch kind of like one. They have like arena mode one they released as well. But I never played Turok 3, and I'm the same as you. I've watched quite a few reviews on this, and to be fair, it's been nothing but praise.
Yeah.
You know, it's Night Dive. You know, they usually hit home runs with these things. It's, you know, 4K native resolution and 120 frames per second on all consoles and PC, which is really nice to see. Obviously touched up the graphics and everything there. And
but one thing I like about that is
modernize the controls.
You know, they haven't gone too far with the graphic upgrades, though. No. I mean, it still looks quite similar to the original, just like you said, kind of upscaled and looks, you know, smoother on modern displays.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and they did number 1 and 2 as well back in like 2015, 2016. They did, you know, those ones as well. So I really need to check this one out. I think it's about, I want to say it's about £25, I think I saw it for. I've put it on my wish list on Xbox. But as always, Night Dive, they're just pumping them out now, aren't they? You know, every couple of weeks there's a new one. And like I say, they're always home runs. You know, they've been really, really, really solid games that they're putting out, and sometimes shedding a bit of life or light onto games that might have been overlooked, because nobody ever really talks about Turok 3. Everybody always talks about Turok 1 and Turok 2. Mm. And Turok 3, you know, I think mostly scored like 7 out of 10, 8 out of 10. You know, 77 on Metacritic. So, you know, not amazing, but, you know, certainly not a bad game. I'm seeing a lot of reviewers coming back to this or playing it for the first time. They're like, actually, this is probably the best of the three. You know, you get two characters you can play as and essentially two campaigns, because they both get different weapons and they both take different routes on the levels and stuff like that. And also, the campaign is only about 3 hours long per character. So nice and short for people like me and Dan, who have never got any time.
It's a series that passed me by, and I think this might be a really good way to experience it. Do you recommend it, Joe?
I recommend it. Turok 1 is a little bit dated, because Turok 1, there isn't as much of a story, and it's very, every level is very go collect this item and then get to the end of the level. Whereas Turok 2 and Turok 3, they're a little bit more kind of like, some people might scream at me for this, but they're a little bit more like Half-Life-y. There's kind of like, there's a narrative to it, and there's a lot more weapons and gore and a lot more like variety in the enemies and stuff. So, you know, dinosaurs and then kind of like humans and then weird alien kind of dinosaur hybrids and stuff. So I would recommend them.
Yeah, no, for me as well, like Turok was kind of one of the games that I remember, just the promotional campaign for that game was massive. Every time I opened, even non-gaming magazines, you know,
Mixmag magazine
and DJ Mag, like, and they'd have like those adverts in there, you know, with a dinosaur head. And
yeah, I remember the screenshots were absolutely everywhere. Mm.
Yeah, so a really interesting franchise. And I think, yeah, like you said, Joe, I've not played the third game, but it's interesting that apparently kind of concludes a story that they set up in the second game as well. So if you've only played that one, it's worth, you know, just to get some completion, downloading that, and like you said, available for all the modern systems now. So I'll link that up. And obviously Night Dive, I think you're right. They just seem to be like the go-to guys for like these fantastic remasters at the moment. Mm. Obviously we had that, you know, Quake 1 and 2 they did recently as well, which were really well done. So look forward to seeing more of what Night Dive will bring us in 2024. Now, this is very cool. I love it when we get new games for retro systems. And this looks right up your street, Joe. A new run-and-gunner game. That's hard to say. A new run-and-gunner game for the not only the Dreamcast, also the PSP and the Neo Geo.
Yeah, Cyborg Force, which is looking to release in mid-2024, coming to physical cartridges, etc., discs. Which is really awesome. But yeah, very in the vein of kind of like somewhere in between Contra and Metal Slug, I would say, in terms of gameplay. Cyborg Force, kind of in the name. It's post-apocalyptic future, nuclear war. the world's been destroyed. We've heard that before. We've heard that once or twice before. And it's been developed by a company called Neo Byte, which I believe this is their first ever commercial video game.
Oh wow!
That they've done. Historically, they've developed board games, but there's a few names behind this, you know, who have been involved in other games and stuff like that. You know, have come together to work for Neo Byte, and it's natively being made for Neo Geo for the AES and MVS. But as you say, it's coming on Dreamcast, PSP, and PC, as well as other emulation devices, and you know, physical release as well.
Yeah, looking at the pricing, I know Neo Geo games are always seen as expensive. This is £333, and you know they've got the obviously the custom cartridge there, which is going to cost a lot as well. And they've got the it's kind of like a VHS style tape that they release it in, and they've got two region choices as well. Even though the game is region free. They've got like a US version and a Japanese version as well, and a 123 meg cartridge. Yeah, I think the fact that they're doing it natively, Neo Geo collecting's expensive. Yeah. That's all I'm going to really say on that.
I often joke to my wife because I like collecting for the Sega Saturn. I always say like, oh God, the Sega Saturn's like the most expensive console to collect for. Like, what am I doing to myself? But no, you kind of forget about the Neo Geo and stuff where games are, you know, they're like £300-500 and all of the new releases that come out for them are like €300, €333, stuff like that.
And it's very much for the hardcore, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But if you don't fancy that and you do just want to buy the ROM on a stick, 37.5, 37.
You see that? Yeah, that's good.
Yeah,
so they've got the options. You know?
Yeah, so a little bit more affordable, but yeah, it does look cool. Interestingly, it's only 2-player on the Neo Geo. So if you buy the Dreamcast or PSP version, it's only 1-player. But if you get the Neo Geo versions, it's 2-player.
Right.
I find that a bit of an odd choice, personally.
I also think that, you know, they're obviously going for a limited market here. Like, and if they had a lot more of these, they'd probably be able to reduce the price. But, you know, they're going to be hitting these at a very small print amount.
I can't imagine they're going to be making thousands of these. I imagine they'll probably make a couple of hundred of the Neo Geo ones. But yeah, the 2-player thing kind of threw me off a little bit because these games, they are historically fantastic 2-player games. You know,
yeah, much more fun.
Yeah, much, much, much more fun. So I don't know if that's a kind of like a conscious choice to try and make people buy the Neo Geo one, or if it's just they couldn't get it to run 2-play. I don't know. I mean, graphically, it doesn't look like it would challenge the Dreamcast at all, to be honest. You know, it's very 16-bit looking, so interesting choice.
If that is their reasoning, then that's very ambitious, isn't it? Yeah, we're going to go. Yeah. People will definitely go out and buy a Neo Geo and spend €350 on a card to play 2-player mode
and pay that for a Neo Geo.
Exactly. So I think you're right there. Yeah, because I mean, we have a few Neo Geo collectors that come on the Patrons Hangout regularly, and they're all used to paying those kind of prices for Neo Geo. I mean, they're essentially arcades, aren't they? Really?
Do you? I think you have a Neo Geo, don't you?
I've got a Neo Geo CD system,
I mean, which plays, is still expensive.
Never even seen it. You know, Dan's got so many odd machines. I'm like, oh, you've got a Neo Geo.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those where it's generally among the Neo Geo community regarded as kind of the worst one to own in terms of, you know, because you've got the loading times off a CD. Which I don't think is too bad though, because I mean, I'm, you know, I'm used to stuff like the, you know, the Mega CD and the, you know, CD32 and stuff like that, which I don't mind. Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind CD loading times if I'm honest, but I think people that are used to the games being kind of from cartridge and instantly playable, it does kind of bug them a bit. But in terms of actually an original Neo Geo machine, the CD one's probably the most affordable from what I've seen. I mean, I got a really good deal on it about 3 years ago now, and I got it for about £80 with the controller.
Really good deal.
Off a friend. So it was, and you can burn the discs as well, you know, download the images off the internet. There's no protection. So, yeah, but I mean, I imagine emulation is probably the way to go for most people if you haven't got the original hardware. Interesting platforms are picked as well, are the PSP and Dreamcast. It seems a bit random. At first, I was like, is there something in common with these systems that makes that port easy? But from what I've seen, it doesn't look like it. It just seems like
I guess there's that kind of built in market of Dreamcast titles, you know, recently coming out, and PSP, I can imagine there's you know, some similar titles and maybe they might be able to port across quite easily. I'm not sure.
I got a PSP not long ago, actually, so it's nice to see some new games coming out on it. So we're keeping an eye on that one. So if you want to check out when that's going to be available, I'll put the link in the show notes. Now, you guys are sporting anything on your wrists at the moment?
Not this.
I've got a Casio G-Shock. Nice. I think it is Casio? I've got a G-Shock anyway, one of those old school ones, you know, but I've got the new version.
Not the ones you could win at the fun fair on the egg machines. No,
I've got the new version. It runs off solar anyway, but I think the only difference with the new version is it's got a blue light instead of a green one on it.
Well, I've got my Apple Watch on, which obviously, you know, nags me all throughout the day, like, stand up, do more exercise, you haven't finished your step counter, my little nagging assistant on my wrist. However, I'm going to say these look pretty nice, although, again, something else, it is quite expensive. I think Joe's been doing a bit of lusting over things that are far out of our price ranges. week. But these are Sega Mega Drive watches that are going to cost an eye-watering $800 each.
Yeah, these are I've just written this off. I'm not a watch guy, to be honest. Like, my dad's big into watches and stuff, but I literally have one watch which I wore on my wedding day, and it was like a £30, like, nice leather strap one.
What's the thing with watches now? They're either, you know, if they're a smart watch, I get the use for them.
Yeah.
They're either that or they're more like a fashion accessory these days, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've not got a smart watch. My wife does. She has the Fitbit one. And to be fair, she used to swear by it. She don't wear it so much anymore.
I'll tell you why I've got a solar one, because my smart one, I was sick of charging it all the time or losing charge on it. You know?
There you go. Look at that. But yeah, if you fancy a new watch and you're a big Mega Drive or Genesis fan, watchmaker Anikorn are launching a range of $800 Sega Mega Drive Genesis console-based watches.
They're a weird design. Like, so I remember, you might remember this, when Batman the movie came out, there was these like little plastic ones you get at Argos that had Batman on the front, like his face with the pointy ears. And then you'd lift up Batman and it'd have like a little LED.
Yes, I do remember those.
Yeah, and it kind of reminds me of the front of the Batman one. But the way that they've designed it, like, there's the Japanese limited edition one.
Yeah.
It's got a little window where you can see the numbers, which I kind of find weird on a watch anyway, but it looks a bit like a Rumba to me.
So it's designed, so think of the Mega Drive Model 1, the circular bit where the cartridge goes, that's what it is. It's designed over after that. It's a remake of that. But
yeah, but just see the kind of robot vacuum.
I see it, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, interestingly, you pointed out there, yeah, you can get the Japanese version. So it comes with the kind of maroon, purpley red, like design with it. Obviously they're all black, but then you can get the Genesis or you can get the European Mega Drive version.
And of course it looks like it's made out of, you know, really high quality stuff, and like on the back, and it's all brushed steel and all of this kind of stuff. So, you know, yeah, if you're into watches and you're watch collecting, I know there's a lot of people, and you're into gaming, it might be something that someone with a lot of spare cash can rock, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, like I say, probably not for me. Bit rich.
Well, I mean, it's obviously a luxury.
Yeah.
Brand, watchmaker company, isn't it, Anikorn? They're, you know, they're selling these for a lot of money, $800 each. But I think the design of them is beautiful. I mean, in particular, the Japanese Mega Drive one. I'm looking at that, and like you said, it's kind of a flat version, isn't it, of the disc that's on the top of the Mega Drive. And even, yeah. I mean, the attention to detail, the power light lights up as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if it just means it's got battery. Might get a bit annoying at night, you know, when it's on your nightstand, that kind of little glowing red light constantly.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. I'm looking now, they're still in stock. Yeah. So fancy one, Dan. Yeah, I like the Japanese one as well. I quite like, of the three, I think that's my favourite looking one as well.
Yeah, so I mean, there's also quite a weird looking Mega Drive one that's just like a transparent watch. Oh, is that the back of it I'm looking at here?
That's the back of it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, so the back of it is transparent.
And also, the case looks quite nice as well. You know, they've themed it and they've kind of got the embossed like logo on the front and the grid that they'd have on some of the Mega Drive titles as well. And like the little, the book of for it looks a bit like a games manual.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like a nice package and stuff. Yeah,
I think it's beautiful. But again, if I did have one of these, that's exactly where it would stay in the case. That's one reason I'm not like a watch collector, apart from not having $800 to splash out on watches. I'd be too nervous walking around with that kind of money.
I'd just be like a new car or a Mega Drive watch.
Yeah. I'd be scraping it on walls and like, I'm too clumsy. But yeah, if you are a watch collector and you want something very unique and something looks very beautiful actually, and a Sega fan, this could be right up your alley. I'll link that in the show notes as well. Now, we've had a lot of new consoles come out, you know, the mini console craze kind of continues. Obviously, we saw Retro Games Limited announcing their roadmap for 2024, plenty of new systems on the way from them. This one is a little bit left of center, though. Now, first of all, I had to kind of be reminded that Commodore is still a thing. Now, obviously, this is not the Commodore of old. I mean, I know you've done videos about this, Ravi, kind of what happened to the name and the amount of companies and stuff it's been through over the years. It's a complicated story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been kind of passed around a lot. And I think there's probably four companies or three companies that are currently Commodore. So I know that you've got Commodore Italy, which we're talking about at the moment. There was a Commodore USA as well. Individual Computers, I think, have the brand Commodore in Germany. I'm not quite accurate with it. I can't keep up with the amount of Commodores that are around or have kind of used the brand recently.
Well, you mentioned about vacuum cleaners as well. And I saw someone put this in our Discord a while back, that there is a company that make basically Commodore-branded Roomba clones. So they're like, you know, robot hoovers with the Commodore logo on top, which is quite interesting to see. But this company we're talking about here, this is the Italian Commodore company, who you might remember, they made the headlines a couple of years ago when they brought out the Pet Phone.
Ah, yes, they did. They did some Commodore-themed phones, which is kind of like an Android phone with an etching of the logos on the back, I think.
I think someone found out, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but I've got a feeling it was just kind of an off-the-shelf Chinese Android phone that they kind of put their logo on from memory. Yeah, and obviously that was a few years ago now, but this company is still kicking, and if you go on their website, they do have quite a few products available. You know, I think, again, these are probably kind of OEM.
I think they're referred to as Commodore Industries, this company.
Right, so. Yeah. Well, I mean, they've got a lot of laptops and stuff on their website, you know, just standard Windows machines. But interestingly, they've been at a convention recently. These are an Italian company, and they've been going to a few trade shows and stuff, including the Milan Games Week event that was on recently. And they're basically trying to, you know, revive Commodore and get the brand back in the limelight as well. And there's an interview on a Italian news website where they're talking about the fact that the guys behind this company, Luigi Simonetti of Commodore Italy, now wants to make a console. So we could be getting a Commodore console in the near future.
Yeah, I think we've seen so many Commodore consoles. I remember Audi did one at one point in Germany. There was a C64 Audi release. There was that Commodore USA did one. We've also seen, obviously, Retro Games Limited have done their Commodore branded the C64 Mini, and I guess it depends what they're going to go for. Are they going to go for kind of just a kind of like little mini system, or are they going to go for slapping something on an Android thing, or are they going to go for a full kind of Amiga style system? Who knows? It's a interesting interview, but it seems like they're kind of aiming to hit that market, especially doing this interview. And it's some of their products, like they've got like a little C64 floppy drive USB key that seems to be sold out at the moment. Right. And they've got a few little games that they're kind of been running as well, but none of them really seem like they're huge kind of retro Commodore Star ones. So I'm not sure how they're going to approach this, but I don't know. Do you think just slapping the name Commodore on something is is going to bring enough people to it, or do you think they need to do more?
They say in this interview here, basically the only information we've got is their goal for the future is to have a console. They're currently doing research and development, and the aim is to have a console with hardware inside that makes the Amiga world compatible. So it looks like whatever the planning is going to be compatible with Amiga games.
Yeah, I didn't see that quote. Okay, interesting, because I know that Amiga kit also has that A600GS that they're just developing. So it's good to see a world where, you know, there's so many options, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, for me, in my mind, Commodore and Amiga have been two completely different things for at least the last 30 years now, haven't they?
Yeah, pretty much. And there was that huge split. I think it was a Tulip computer. Bought the Commodore branding back in the days, and then ESCOM separated off for the Amiga branding.
Yeah, I mean, very, very messy in the late 90s and early 2000s as to kind of where the brands both went, you know, in separate ways. But that, I mean, one thing that I do like is, you know, it would be nice to see like a Commodore machine that can run Amiga games again. Obviously, we've got stuff like the A500 Mini, and they're bringing out the Maxi that everyone's kind of naming it next year as well. So it'll be interesting to see kind of where this fits in the market. But yeah, I mean,
I think it's a good situation. You know, for years we didn't have any Commodore or Amiga hardware, not even something with just a logo slapped on it. So, you know, it's good to have so many about and lots of options. Yeah, but let's see what this becomes.
Yeah, and there's always space in my console collection for a couple of new additions. So
still after that Commodore Rumba anyway. So not like me would probably go for anything. Yeah.
Ask Santa Ravi, be a good boy. You never know.
Can I please get a Commodore Rumba?
A what? So we'll keep an eye on that. It could be some interesting news in 2024 from the Commodore stable. So I'll link that up. And of course, the rest of the stories we talk about, you can find them all every week on your podcast app or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, we're going to get into this week's interview, talking about some incredible companies from back in the day. Of course, Cinemaware, MicroProse, Virgin as well, with Ed Magnin. He's coming up in just a moment. Before we do that, let's take a moment to give a massive thank you to our wonderful friends at ExpressVPN. Now, we love ExpressVPN. They've been such a big supporter of this podcast throughout 2023, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Really good piece of software. I just love it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, obviously, ExpressVPN is our choice of VPN. And maybe right now, you know, you're kind of looking at holiday presents, Christmas presents for your family. There is one thing that you'll find. I mean, I don't know about you guys. If I ever search for something, or, you know, maybe looking for stuff to buy the missus, obviously that gets in your history. And you find that you suddenly get ads recommending it all over, don't you? Your browser and everything like that. Because obviously,
yeah, and it's usually recommending the thing that you've already bought.
Yeah. And then obviously, you know, if your missus comes in the room and you're on and there's adverts popping up, she kind of gets an idea. Or maybe your kids, you know, if you've got kids, you're shopping for them online. It might kind of give away what you're doing. So ExpressVPN is an app that you can have on your computer. You can have it on your phone as well. And it encrypts all of your online traffic. So no matter what you do, it all stays completely private. Because a lot of people think, you know, I'll do incognito mode, that'll save you. But incognito mode does nothing except hide your history from yourself. So if you haven't got ExpressVPN turned on, that's the thing, you know, your browsing history is out there, your ISP knows what you're doing, all these websites can track what you're doing too and serve you adverts up as well. And the good thing about ExpressVPN is you can take it on the road with you as well. So, you know, if you're at home, if you're traveling, if you're at work.
Yeah, I find that really important because, you know, if you're on holiday or you're visiting family and friends and stuff and you're staying in like hotels and stuff with unsecure networks, it's really important to kind of protect yourself, and ExpressVPN is really good for that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I'm going to basically an Airbnb this weekend. I'm staying in, you know, we're going away to Buxton for a few days, and obviously I'm going to be using their Wi-Fi there as well.
Yeah.
You know, do you trust the people that run the Airbnb to respect your privacy? You know, get ExpressVPN on. They can't track anything. So we've been using it for many years now. And I think ExpressVPN has been supporting this podcast for about 5 years now. So there's no way we'd let anyone else see our browsing history. You know, ExpressVPN encrypts it all. And we want to give you an incredible Christmas offer. Now, maybe you're looking for a VPN at the moment. So many advantages to having one. Use our link. you're going to really help out the podcast. And not only sign up to a one-year plan, we'll give you 3 months extra for free. So use our link so they know that we sent you, expressvpn.com/retro. That's expressvpn.com/retro. And thank you so much to ExpressVPN for their continued support of our show. Now, I don't know about you lads. Obviously, I've been self-employed for a while. You are as well, Ravi. I've got a Christmas party this year.
I have next week.
Aren't we going to Joe's for some kind of Christmas party? I think I'm crashing other people's Christmas parties.
Well, I thought, you know, if we can't go to a party, let's bring the party to us. And we do this every year, the Retro Hour virtual Christmas party. Obviously, we do our patrons hang out every month, but there is always something special about the December one, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be doing the Christmas hangout on Friday the 15th, aren't we?
Next week, yeah, so yes. Friday night we're doing it. And we've done the patrons hangout on a Friday before. It always gets a little bit more rowdy, I think, than on the Sunday night, doesn't it? Because obviously, start of the weekend, like we said, everyone's in, you know, full-on Christmas merriment, you know, just kind of the week before Christmas. So, you know, Christmas jumpers are not compulsory, but encouraged. We do like to see them.
I think it's the one with the most drinking on, isn't it?
Yes. That's what I was alluding to there. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people come on in their costume and, you know, Christmas backgrounds and all that. And obviously, we talk about our Christmas plans, a lot of memories and stuff too. It is also such a giggle. So if you haven't joined us for a hangout at all in 2023, this is a very good time to jump on, and you'll get an invite to our virtual Christmas party that is coming up next Friday night, Friday the 15th of December from 8 p.m. UK time. So join us on Patreon now. You'll be invited to that. And of course, there are plenty of other perks for joining us on Patreon. You often get the podcast early. You get it ad-free every week. We do an extra 10-15 minutes of news stories on every episode just for our patrons. And if you join us as a gold member or above, you get invited to check out our bonus podcast, of which I think there are 38 episodes of this after we record next week's.
Yeah, the after hours, the retro hour after hours, where we just kind of let our hair down, let loose. We kind of anything goes on the after hours, doesn't it? You know, we usually have a theme. We do the retro years every couple of months where we kind of review, you know, games and tech from a particular year. You know, we've covered quite a few of the 90s and 2000s, a couple of the 80s. That's always really fun. Or often we kind of, sometimes people want to hear a little bit more about us, so we kind of give our opinions, you know, top fives of certain consoles and games.
Yeah, sometimes they recommend games for us to play as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, yeah, I love it when we do that. We need to do that again.
Yeah,
and we need to get some more patrons on the news as well. Bryce, we will get you on. Don't worry.
So if you want to check out the bonus podcast, a lot of listening there for, you know, if you've got a couple of weeks off over Christmas. Next week, we're going to be doing our Christmas special of that as well, talking about Christmas memories and gaming and tech that reminds us of Christmas has gone by. So you get an invite to that, your own personal RSS link. A very good time to join us on Patreon, and make sure that we can continue the podcast into 2024. All the details to sign up are on our website right now at theretrohour.com.
And I just want to say to the patrons, thanks so much for supporting us throughout the year as well. It's been fantastic, and we know it's a tough time, but you know, you've allowed us to keep the show going, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we couldn't have done it without you. Right, then, of course, you can check out all the news stories in the show notes every week. You don't have to Google around, to save you the job. A little favour to ask as well, if you have got a little bit of time over Christmas, we do appreciate that, you know, people have a little bit of holidays. You can probably spend it with the family, but if you get a couple of seconds, one thing that's going to really help us as we go into 2024 is leave us a little review, if you can, on the platform that you listen on. Particularly, you know, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, really helps us get in front of new people, helps us get up the charts as well, and warms our hearts to see lovely comments on there as well, doesn't it? So we'd really appreciate it if you can just take a couple of seconds to leave us a nice review and a 5-star a little rating on there. That always really helps. Right then, so we'll see you for our Christmas specials next Friday, kicking off with the best of 2023, and then of course the Christmas quiz. I can hear a few nerves when I mention that. Won't give any spoilers. So yeah, look forward to that, and enjoy the start of your Christmas season if you are celebrating that this year. And next, we're going to talk to this week's special guest, getting the inside story on companies like CinemaWare and MicroProse Virgin as well, with Ed Magnin. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Ed Magnin, and we're going to be talking about so many different things, kind of going from 1979 to, you know, the Game Boy Advance and Nintendo DS as well. So there's a whole great history there of working at great companies like CinemaWare, MicroProse as well, and Virgin Games. How are you doing, Ed?
Oh, great. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, yeah, it's great to have you on. Now, we have a question that we ask all of our guests, and this kind of, you know, takes them back a bit. And this is, what was your first kind of video game or computer experience that you can remember?
Well, I had done the online business where we were, I was on the Apple II. I bought it as a hobby when I was teaching, and I go to club meetings in Los Angeles. There was like an Apple club. Jobs and Wozniak would fly down from the Bay Area to come and talk to us once in a while. And I was looking at, they showed off the Lisa, the Apple III that was their Edsel, you know, their one big terrible machine, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I got to see them. And then I looked at the club when I go to this club meetings on the weekend and, you know, once a month. And I looked around the room and people were starting businesses. And I said, well, I'm as good or better than those guys are. Why don't I? So I went around and tried to sell some software to some companies and they didn't offer me very much. So then I said, well, the hell with that. I'll figure out how to do it myself. And I developed an online business that people downloaded through modems, which were only, if I say they were 300 baud, which yeah. That's okay. 56K. This is 0.3K. It wasn't even in the ballpark of any kind of dial up that we use.
So how did it work then? Because that was in like 1979 then. And,
right. Exactly. So what happened was I went to the UCLA library and I got some reference books on X.25, which was the network that Telenet and TimeNet used as dial up networks.
Yeah.
And it had error checking in it. And so you could send if you couldn't send it reliably, I'm not going to send you an 8-minute download and then have you complain that you didn't get a good transfer, you know? So I've had to know that I was sending it reliably. So we sent blocks of data, like packets of like 256 bytes with a 2-byte checksum. And if the checksum matched, it continued to go forward. And if it didn't match, it repeated the last block. And so we knew when we sent you the thing, it was reliable. Now, then how do we get your money? We charge your credit card. And we say, okay, this game is $25. And you give us your credit card. Now, we establish an account for you earlier. You'd leave your information and we'd set up an account. And then we'd know how to get a hold of you, you know, if there was a problem. But basically, we're trusting you. And then as far as submitting them for payment, they weren't set up to let us do it electronically. So we would print them out on paper and take them to the bank, and they said telephone order where the signature would go.
So you essentially had like a kind of software delivery service, but you also had submissions to it. And
we took games from other people. We did a lot of them ourselves, but we had about maybe one of the brochures I have online I think had the number, but it was like maybe 60-70 titles. They weren't all games. There were some games. And, you know, Apple came out with a mouse, which was kind of funny. I think it was a one-button mouse. And we had a mouse maze where you moved the mouse around. So not that many people had the mouse, but the people that bought the mouse, we gave them a game they could play on it. And we did a telegammon where you could play backgammon over the phone. We did a chess one where you could play chess over the phone with somebody else. And what it did was you bought the game. The game sent enough of itself to your friend, so he didn't even have to buy it. But he could play with you. Now, when he wanted to play with somebody else, he needed his own copy to play with. And then it would send enough of the screen and everything so that when you made a move, it would move it on his side too.
That's insane. Like, you look at stuff now, like the App Store and how quick it is to, you know, download something and connect with your card.
Oh, and believe me, I'm much happier not doing that. Okay, I was proud I invented a system that nobody was even close to us. People filed patents on things that were several years late even, you know, to shoot down their patent, you just have to have prior art that's a year and a day before them, you know, and there was an international gift exchange. I worked with some of the top law firms around the world, including, I think, Rose Law in London, everybody that needed help fighting these patents because people had patented them, and the British ones trailed by a couple of years. So we were still, after I'd gotten all the money I could get for helping as an expert witness the U.S. cases, then I got hired to help with the British cases and stuff. And anyway, it was an interesting thing. But I'm so glad now that I don't worry about it. I know I did it and I could download stuff and I figured out how to do it. But now I'm glad that Apple and the Windows Store and Google Play and Amazon, you know, that they take care of that for me. And I used to run home on New Year's Eve because the system was actually running on Apple IIs, and it didn't have a day-date calendar, and it had a time, we could set the time. But at the end of the year, it had a switch. We had to switch it to like 2024. You had to rush home on New Year's Eve to make sure you change the year.
That's how you spent your midnight then.
Yeah, I spent my midnight doing that. And then people would call us, and there was a little bit of fraud, but you know, we'd catch the people because we wouldn't activate an account for them unless we had a working phone number. You know, if we, the guy leave his information, we call him. So CBS News sent a crew out to film. It was the first story they did on personal computers. And then they said, Ed Magnin quit a teaching job in Southern California to do his own, to provide his own computer games to other computer buffs around the world. And so on. And then what amazed them was, they said, just do what you normally would do. Well, in the evening, in the daytime, I use the computers because it costs too much for people to phone us in the daytime. In the evening, when the rates went down, we leave all the lines answering for customers. And I was in the other room watching television. So I'm watching the CBS News in the other room while people are placing orders on the thing. You know, it was clicking back and forth, and people would call up and they'd say they're Abraham Lincoln and stuff. And then once or twice it was embarrassing where it was somebody famous that you know, and they call up and they say, well, the guy calls me back and says, "Isn't my money good enough for you?" Like, welcome, you didn't sell me. Because I thought it was a fake, you know.
You thought they were a prankster then.
Yeah. People like Todd Rundgren was one of our customers, you know. It's like
I was wondering how much the Apple II kind of expandability and hardware helped with developing this system, and, you know, having like add-ons and extra boards.
Not really. We had to get enough storage. So we had just the normal floppies, like a two drive system, you know, and it's answering the phone, and it's got to have the games it's selling and keep a log of what people are buying so we can print out the credit card slips the next day and everything. So to that part, but then later we got an 8-inch drive, dual 8-inch drives. The 8-inch drives use the top and the bottom. So it gave us quite a bit more capacity, but even that wasn't enough. And then we went to a Corvus hard drive, and I had to take out a bank loan. I think the drive cost like 20 grand for a 20 megabyte hard drive. We're not talking about gigabyte, terabyte. This is, yeah, it was like, you know what happened? The initial, when you bought an Apple II, the first, it came with 16K. The next 16K cost you $300.
Wow.
Okay. The next 16K after that cost about 100 because the price had gone down. More competent, you know, more people were making. And then I think it was like $65, you know, for another 16K. You know, so over my lifetime, I've seen memory go way down in price and other things. And you could buy a computer each year. You spend $1,500 to $3,000 on a computer, but it's a better computer each year than it was the year before, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting with that culture as well, because you guys, obviously, a lot of developers had Apple IIs and you were all kind of using that. And in Britain, we had lots of different systems, but you ended up working with Cinemaware as well, which is a really big name over here as well.
Yeah, I had fun. The people that ran it were a little weird. And then they got taken over years later. They bought them out of bankruptcy, some guys from Brazil or something. They bought them. And then they called up and they said, "Are you the Ed Magnin that did this? And do you have the source code for this game? Okay, you have to send it to us. We own the company now." I said, "I don't have to do whatever." You know?
Like, well, I was wondering as well, because they used Amigas for development, right? So what?
Now that was an interesting thing, was that Cinemaware used Amigas. And the advantage was that they made the game look good on the Amiga, and then they ported it down to the other platforms. And by to the Commodore 64, or you got to the EGA or VGA PC, it didn't look like much of anything. But you could put the box out with the pictures from the Amiga and say, "Your screenshots may vary," you know. What they did was they had a box that had the game in it, and then they put a sticker on it for which version it was, whether it was the Apple II GS or was Apple II or was Commodore. And so they were able to get away with that way. Now, when I worked at MicroProse, they did the opposite. And by the way, I was there. I was one of maybe about their eighth or ninth programmer they hired. Wow. I used to eat lunch with Sid Meier every day, you know, did Civilization.
And, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so he did a game and Pirates. And so they brought up this guy from North Carolina, Randall Masteller, and I went down to Sid's office for a week, and he explained Pirates to us because he just finished it. He didn't want to stop while he was working on it, tell us anything. He was going to get completely done for the Commodore 64. And that was my job to make an Apple II and Apple II GS version. And Randall Masteller went back to North Carolina and made a PC version. And Randall had a way of, he'd look at the Commodore 64 code, and he had some macros he'd typed that kind of made it easy to like retype it back in and get it the way you need it. I took a look at what Sid had done, and I got it going on the Apple II. Now, it's interesting because the Apple II and the Commodore 64 had the same chip. They had 6502s.
Yes, yeah.
But that would all similarity stop there. And the Apple II screen was weird. It was 40 characters across. And if you put in a card that made it 80 characters across, it was weird because even the 40 character screen, when you went across the top line and then you went one more character, you were down a third of the screen.
And also, I guess you're also going from like color to black and white as well, which is another kind switch with the palette.
Yeah, well, Apple had, if the high res had four, it was purple, green, white if they're both on. If you have a purple pixel and a green pixel next to each other, they turn white. And if you have neither of them, you got black. And so that was the high res. The low res had about 12 colors, you know, it's supposed to be 16, but some of them were duplicates. Some of the grays were duplicates of each other and just with a different number. But yeah, so they had that kind of thing, but, and then the basic was different. Somebody had published a basic book back in those days. It was like a dictionary of basic commands and it's like print. And then it would say, okay, on the Commodore 64, you type this, and on the Apple II, you type this, and on the Radio Shack computer, you type this, and the Timex Sinclair. So it was like all these things. Oh, the old days, was it load something, comma, 8, 1, you know, on the Commodore 64, you had to type some weird, you couldn't just load and get, you stuck a floppy in, and then you had to type this thing to get it to go. Oh, by the way, too, in those days, the market in the UK was for tape cassettes.
Yes, yeah.
And so we made a game on a disc, and then we had to load it to a tape cassette. And we got like, let's see, in pounds, I think it was like maybe like 10 pounds for the cassette and 15 pounds for the, you know, for the disc or something. So nobody bought it. They buy their own tape and maybe copy to a floppy themselves.
Yeah. And also piracy on the tapes was rife as well. Yeah.
We spent all this extra trouble making the thing. And then when we were done, everybody was buying it wrong. And I said, I know how to fix that problem. Change the price, flip the two prices. And people will buy the discs, which are actually easier to make and safer for us. So,
and I guess you were also going to different sizes then as well, and had to kind of work with size limitations and storage.
Oh, yeah, all of that stuff. And okay, then what do you do? The original purpose, I was teasing somebody that did music. I said, the original purpose of music and games was to mask a long disc load. Like, we did a helicopter one, was it one of Sid's? I helped get it going, but I never did the whole game, I think. But it was like we were flopping. We could page flip between two screens to make it look like the helicopter, like its blade was moving. And while that was going on, we were loading. Now, normally you could not load on the Apple II and display something at the same time. They wouldn't let you program and do that. So I had to write in an assembly language to get more basic control of it. And I could have a thing that was doing loading. And while it was loading, was flipping the two pages, you know, so it would keep the animation running. So there were times when we told you, okay, you finish level one. Now you got to turn the floppy over and then wait 2 minutes while it loads. Have a thermometer on the screen. You know,
also there was like some tricks with custom fonts as well. I think
we did some custom fonts. We were able to get. I actually had a. I had a was it, the composite monitor, normal one. And on a composite monitor, we could get pixels. We could get like a 3.5 wide pixel. We could get like more characters across the screen and have them do it a certain way. But then when we got, it didn't work right on a, on the one that was the built-in, the NT, not the NTSC, the
RGB, whatever.
RGB. The yeah. RGB monitor, it would not, you, the font was totally unreadable. So we warned people on the box, requires composite monitor. You know?
Okay. So, yeah, so
that the was... other way around. Oh, there was a bug too in the Apple. There are a lot of bugs in hardware. And you see, Apple didn't have to fix them. What are they going to do? Give everybody a new computer. On the Apple II, if you made a box that was 320 by 200 and you got over to, so 0 to 319, if you put a pixel in the column 319, you didn't see it. So you went over to 318 and put the pixel there, and now it was 2 pixels wide. If you wanted 1 pixel line, you had to go to 317. And you see, I showed Apple that. I called them up and I showed them. Then the thing was, how come you're finding all this stuff? Nobody else is finding. When I was doing stuff on the 2GS, I was finding all these bugs where things would crash. And they said, well, you're the only one finding us. I said, well, what's everybody else doing? Oh, you're the only one using an Apple 2GS. Everybody else is programming on the Mac.
But yeah, I was going to say, what were the kind of differences of working on the Mac and then the 2GS?
Now, when I did the 2GS, they didn't get me a Mac, so I was doing it on a piece on an Apple 2GS, and I had a hard drive that was like a lunchbox. And I think that was may have been a 20, instead of being 20,000 by then, maybe it was like a couple of thousand, you know, to have it like a lunchbox thing. And I had a multiplex switch that I put on it, and I got another Apple 2GS. I told the company to buy me a second one because it took 40 minutes to compile the program.
Oh, wow.
So what happened was I would start it compiling on one side of my desk. I had one on the left side of the desk and one on the right side. I started compiling on the left and have the hard drive working with that one. And then I'd go over to the other computer and look at the code while it was compiling, and I'd catch mistakes myself before. And so then I'd abort the compile and switch it to that side. And then go. So I was constantly doing that. And I had a program where it took me a long time to compile the code. I had a friend that did a graphics thing, and it took him a long time to compile the graphics. You know, it was all kind of the way you built the thing up and how much you had to compile and all that. But yeah, it was a pain, all that stuff. And then I think the 2GS, we tried to use C on it. In the early games, people, you know, using a high-level language like C, what happened was, they used BASIC because BASIC is an interpreted language, and people that were hobbyists could buy like a Timex Sinclair or whatever and type in BASIC commands. And what happens is with BASIC, you type in something and you hit a carriage return, and then it processes that line. And if it has a line number in front of it, it becomes line 10, let's say, and then you put line 20. If you put line 15, it puts line 15 between 10 and 20 automatically. If you don't put a line number and you say print, quote, hello, end quote, and it would just print the word hello on your screen because it's not deferred processing, then it's doing it immediately. So it's a difference when you're programming, you're writing instructions, and then you say, okay, now run, and it runs, you know, it's not running at the minute you're doing it, you know, so that people have trouble that aren't programmers understanding that, but it's a big distinction. But yeah, so we got, we were doing that kind of stuff, and we were getting stuff that would build on there, and so C was a compiled language instead. And the problem with the early platforms was, even though there was a C developed for almost all of them at one time or another, the runtime package for C was so big that it wasn't worth using it. It took up too much space. And when we got to cartridges, when you got to Nintendo and you started getting cartridges and later Atari and everything else, you had to pay to put that runtime on the cartridge.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so that's another problem. Okay, now another thing, the big thing, if nobody gets anything else out of this talk today, the one thing to keep in mind is that programming a cartridge game, like a Game Boy, now Apple was you know, on tape and floppies and stuff, you know, but when you go to cartridges, when you go to like Nintendo and you're making a Nintendo 60, the original one, what was it, not 64, the
NES.
Yeah. When you do that, you're making a cartridge. And some of those cartridges were $40 games, they had a $20 cartridge in them, you know, and some of them may have had a less expensive cartridge. So you end up having these things that you can't make a mistake. It isn't like you could go and upgrade it 5 minutes later, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So, you know, Cinemaware, like their titles were really, well, cinematic, and that was kind of part of it. And, you know, they were quite iconic as well. When you finally did it and, you know, released it, what was the kind of code checking like and, you know, the kind of requirements before release?
Well, now, I didn't send any, I didn't do any of the ones that the other guys had bought the company that did the Nintendo and Super Nintendo Cinemaware titles. We did.
Yeah, I'm on about the Apple ones a bit earlier. Yeah,
we did Amiga, and I did Apple IIgs. I don't think we bothered with the Apple II on it, as I recall. And we did PC ones and stuff. So Cinemaware had their own testing room and everything. Oh, by the way, they didn't have the MicroProse. You'll be interested in this. MicroProse had a room with UK power supplies.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And probably power monitors as well. Yeah.
So they had outlets on the wall with a different color thing. And those were 220 50 cycles instead of 110 60 cycles. And by the way, when you go to do a PAL, PAL is the standard for Europe for those things. When you go to do a PAL game, you have less vertical blank. Yes. A lot of times we have to hide things on a Nintendo in the vertical blank, trying to do stuff the vertical blank is when you used to have a TV. Well, nobody's old enough to have a TV that used to scroll and you'd see those black lines on them. But if you see an old movie, each frame of a movie, it's kind of like if it gets out of sync and starts scrolling and you see the black lines going up your screen, you know, the old frame sliding up. Well, that black line is the vertical blank, and you could send stuff in there. You had a couple of milliseconds or whatever, you could send something. And then you had there's also a horizontal blank over on the side, too, before it gets where the carriage returns, before it gets back to the left of the screen again. But yeah, so we had to do a lot of stuff in that period. But also, so the Euro ones were even more fighting to get more to have the less time to do stuff in the blank there and stuff. But then having the right frame rate and the right thing, and then I think for some reason the PAL I think is also in Australia or something, but you see that, well, the UK speaks the same language as we do, but the it wasn't just the language thing. And then Nintendo had country of origin stuff where you buy an 8-bit cartridge and then you'd want to play it on we buy a Japanese game before it was on US, you know, to see the early versions, early release. We'd go to a Japanese market in Southern California. We'd buy games before they were officially released in the US and we'd look at them, but we had to have an adapter. And later we found out we just had to bend some pins on the end of the cartridge so that we could plug it into American unit and look at it.
Well, I remember you said that you did some stuff with Virgin Games as well. I was wondering what it was like when Prince of Persia came out originally. Like, do you remember that? Because you know, the impact of that game and how popular it was, it's kind of hard to think about nowadays.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. And of course, when we did it, it was all, the Game Boy was all black and white. So it created some challenges. And then you want a ghost, and we don't have enough room to put all the thing. And this is a kind of a secret in the industry. Nobody ever wanted to buy larger than the minimum size cartridge. Okay, because if you paid $2 for the next size cartridge extra, you got to add $5 to the price tag, and then they felt they priced themselves out of the market.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's a $40 game now, a $45 game. Well, maybe they're not going to be able to sell them. And also, everybody tried to sell the games the first day. I think it was U.S. Gold, isn't the U.S.? That's the British company. They were the reps for MicroProse, and we'd send over a game to them. And they'd sell them all the first day, and then they wouldn't want any more. Nobody wants to have a warehouse full of games they can't sell that are on cartridge.
True.
$20 cartridge sitting there. So and if it takes months to order, we'd order games from. So you make a game in the U.S. and you have to jump through a U.S. hoop of sending it to Nintendo in Seattle, And when they approve it, then you have to jump through the Japanese hoop that the Japanese companies jump through and get it approved in Japan. Then they manufacture it, and they would put it on a slow ship to you unless you pay extra to have it air freighted. And of course, you're paying her. That's why they say Christmas in July. To save money, you got to have your game done by July 1st or something to get it out by Christmas, you know?
So was there a difference when you, so you moved from the Apple One to the Game Boy, and then you had, obviously you're talking about approval, you had that Nintendo seal of approval as well. Was there, was there any kind of requirements, or did they end up sending any games back and you had to change
stuff? Well, they sent a lot of them back to other developers.
Okay, so they would fix it then.
Okay, or, I had the perfect record of sending 10 submissions to Nintendo and getting 10 of them approved the first time.
That's great.
And when I was an employee, they just benefited from my being good. And when I went off and became a contractor and came back to them and said, you know, I'll do this, I would add an extra couple of grand in my contract for the first approval. Because it would save them weeks.
I can imagine that could delay a whole game process and a game release. Yeah.
Okay, there was a game, Magic Johnson Super Slam Dunk, that was on the Super Nintendo. And Virgin Games had a contract with Magic Johnson, and the contract, it was so long in development that Magic Johnson came out, he got AIDS or HIV or whatever it was. They didn't know what it was at the time. They thought it was, anyway. So then he wasn't cured, but he was back playing again.
and it took that long for the whole approval. Wow.
While the game was being made and everything. Okay. Now, what happened was the game, the basketball game, they had Chick Hearn, the voice of the Lakers. He had a lot of colorful expressions. And it takes like five vertical blanks even just to get the expression. So you're talking about 60 frames a second, so a 12th of a second, just to get the phrase loaded in. And everybody says Q speech. By the way, Q isn't even an American English word. We use it for, you know, computers. Yeah. You guys queue up for a bus, you know.
Yeah, we love queuing.
You know, we get in line. We line up for something. But yeah, everybody says you queue the speech. So you put in order the things you're going to say. Well, the problem was when the play was over, Chick Hearn was talking for 2 minutes. He's had more stuff to say that he hadn't said yet.
Well, yeah, that's another thing as well, sound. But
So what I did was I said, you don't want to cue the speech. You want to prioritize the speech. So we got play-by-play speech. And what you want to do is you want to say certain things are mandatory to say them, the end of the play thing. Okay, in football, somebody gets sacked. The quarterback, somebody tackles the guy and he doesn't get a chance to pass it. It's, oh, wow, big sack or something like, you know, where did that guy come from? And so you got something you say to end the play. But you had something else you were loading and you'd say he's back to pass because the quarterback would go back and then he would pick somebody off in the distance to throw it to. So he's back to pass. Well, he gets tackled before you get to say that. So you abort that. You don't bother loading it because it's just going to slow you down. You skip. When I work with the deaf and you're trying to keep up with sign language, every once in a while you have to drop a sentence.
Yeah.
There's enough redundancy that maybe the person you're helping you'll be able to squeeze two thoughts into the next sentence, you know.
Especially with like size limitations. But
yeah, exactly. And the speed limitations, how much you can get in there. So,
talking of speed as well, like, in Prince of Persia is such a good port on the Game Boy. That whole game was about like realism platforming, but also the kind of rotoscope graphics. How did you go about kind of making sure that it ran smoothly and worked well as a platformer with such big sprites as well?
That was very tricky. But just before we get to that, I want people to understand that the when you make a cartridge game, you can't make any mistakes.
Yeah, there's no firmware updates that you can do later on. No, yeah.
I used to go to a store and I'd buy NHL 2K or something and I drive home and there's five updates to download when I get home, my PC.
Hey, you get those kids that buy a console nowadays at Christmas and then they're sitting there for 2 hours updating it before they can play on it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. New versions of Xcode and new versions with the DirectX and all that baloney. Yeah, so we go through, but I was used to getting things right the first time, you know, and not having. So I thought they should give me a bonus if I got a game out and it got out on time, and Nintendo didn't have to reject it, and I had to have to fix it and take 3 more weeks or a month or whatever. Okay, so then I also thought that if your game lasted 6 months or a year without having an update that you had to do. Now, if you did have an update, if there was a serious problem, maybe you would make another cartridge, but you wouldn't tell everybody. But if somebody called up to complain to customer service, then they say, oh, you know what? We do have a newer one. If you'll return yours, we'll send you the new one.
Ah, smart. Yeah.
Yeah. So things like that. Somebody beat, I did Caesar's Palace on the Game Boy.
Yes. Yes.
Somebody beat the math in the casino.
Well, I was going to say about that as well. You know, it was a mouse controller, a cursor, and controlling that on the Game Boy, it worked really well, actually, with that title. That must have been quite tough to implement as well. You don't see that often.
I know, and having that move around and move from thing to thing and see what you're over, and then you click on it. Now, I had fun doing a similar game myself. Oh, by the way, I tried to get the Caesars license to do it on we did a Magnum casino game that's on all the, on the
Android, iOS and stuff.
All the new platforms. Okay. So we did that, and I wanted to get the Caesars license from it. So I called up the same guys there 20 years later that worked with me at Caesars. I tried to get the license. He says, Ed, I'm sorry, we're not allowed to sell anything that might encourage people to gamble.
Oh, wow. And that was on. That came out on the Game Boy as well, you know, a kid's system as well, pretty much.
And I said, well, okay, I drive from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, you know, it's about 3 or 4 hours, whatever. I said, I see a million Caesars ads all the way up there, you know, and they said, yeah. No, you look carefully, we're selling the casino, we're selling Anne Margaret, you know, now Celine Dion, and now somebody else, maybe Taylor Swift or somebody. You know, they're selling that, they're not selling gambling, you know. And so it's like, we don't want to encourage people. We don't want compulsive gamblers, you know? So that was the thing. So I couldn't get the license for that, but we did that on there. And then, I think I was in Los Angeles and, it was on the one we did for the DS, the Nintendo DS. That one has the arrow thing for the, where you're touching a table and you're picking the seat you want to stick at the table. And then it has speech recognition. I was in Los Angeles for E3, and Sharp Electronics was there, and they'd done the speech recognition for Nintendo, and they wanted me to see it. Well, the guy that was in charge of developer relations wasn't very nice to me ever. So I said he should change his title to publisher relations, because he didn't care about people like me. He cared about the people that bought the cartridges, you know. But and we're the ones that would recommend you need a larger cartridge, you know, but they wouldn't, you know. So anyway, we'd go ahead and so I heard this speech recognition. It worked beautifully. And so I said to the two guys in Japanese that were showing it, I speak Japanese. I said, I love this. Can you make sure I get it? They said, well, absolutely, make sure. And then the guy from the Nintendo America, I said, by the way, are you following? Is it Steve Okimoto? I said, are you following? And he says, I don't speak a word of Japanese.
I'm sure that also got used in, I think, Nintendogs. Or one of the kind
of games where you could control with voice. Now, the trouble was I had to learn it used an unusual way of doing text to speech of doing the speech recognition. It used a text to speech. You put in text what you wanted them to recognize as speech.
Okay.
So I had to misspell roulette.
Yeah.
R-O-U-L-E-T.
To get the different pronunciations.
So that when somebody said that, now what we did was, it was also context sensitive. Once you chose the game you were at, if you're a blackjack and you say double down, it was listening for that. It wasn't listening for you to say red 17 or something, you know, or whatever on it knew once you chose the game, then it could load the phrases it should listen to for that one. But yeah, it was a lot of fun and doing this kind of stuff and trying to keep things going. And, you know, we've just been – oh, the other thing, too, is besides not wanting to make a mistake in a game, they want you to upgrade your games at least once a year. If you let it go 2 or 3 years, they'll kick you out of the store.
Yeah, and I think, kind of going from 8-bit titles as well to handheld titles, do you think that was kind of like a second lease of life for a lot of developers, because they use similar techniques, they use similar ideas, but, you know, in a kind of different form?
Well, I'll tell you what it did for me. I had a history of being like 2 years at one company and 2 years at the next. You finish one game and you did it in a ridiculous amount of time and you rushed it and you got it ready. And then they said, you know, here's $25. Take your wife out to Sizzler, you know, to do buffet dinners. It's like, oh, okay, never mind. And so then you do it maybe another year. You hang around and you can do even a better job the next year. I did Caesar's Palace and Prince of Persia in 14 months back to back.
Wow. Yeah.
And you think that would be worth something? And they took me out to say goodbye when I'd given up my notice, and they made me an offer. And I said, Steve, I'm making more than that now. I said, you know, I didn't think you were going to make me an offer. He was going to the UK to meet with the other people at Virgin, you know. It was like, I said, and so I was saying goodbye to him that week instead of the next week. I said, you know, I'm making more than that now. I said, at least if you're going to make me an offer, make me, you know, get your math right.
And yeah, so, I think a lot of programmers got the kind of raw end of the deal.
We love making games. You know, now the one thing we never got to do is you look at these book authors signing their books in a bookstore. So, well, now there aren't any more bookstores.
It's like, yeah, I was also
got that kind of recognition, but it's fun. But you know, I used to have fun when my daughter, she's older now, but when she was in school, I'd go to her school career fair, and they got the guy from the Army and the Navy and the drugstore, everybody that's insurance salesman, and I'm there to talk about games. And this one teacher, he had this chewing gum policy, and throw out your gum and I hate it because he gets under the chair. He had to give this speech to these kids that weren't even his students. They were just assigned to that room that day so that I could give a talk to him because they asked to hear about games. And so then when he's all done, I said, are you done? And the guy says, yeah. And I said, well, if you like chewing gum, this is a career for you.
Well,
nobody gives a crap if you chew gum or not. You know, you'll be happy. Then it backfired on me because my daughter later had him for a physics class. He said, I remember you.
I was also wondering, like, you know, so there was a lot of, when you went onto the Game Boy Advance, you know, you did quite a lot of titles on there and also the Game Boy Color. Like, how similar was the hardware to the SNES? Like, you know, developing on the SNES and then going onto the Game Boy Advance.
You know, it's funny because the same people kind of were involved, I guess. So you got people like Shigeru Miyamoto driving the art, and there was a guy. I can't remember his last name. Anyway, there was a guy that drove the hardware at Nintendo. And so they're kind of taking the 8-bit SNES, 8-bit NES over to the 16-bit for the Super Nintendo, but then also kind of implementing, and there was, it had vertical blanks too. It doesn't have a video, but it had an LCD screen or whatever.
Yeah.
So there were things that kind of got carried over from, in the functions were the same. Now, when they went to the N64, then they had bought a chip from Silicon Graphics. Mm-hmm. And it was the chip they used to draw the stuff in Jurassic Park and everything. And those used to cost like $75,000 for the computer and another $75,000 for the software. And Nintendo was putting one in the N64. So I had an emulation. I had an emulator for the N64. At first I was using a Silicon Graphics computer and I got like one frame a second. Okay. And when they gave me the hardware to plug in, I got 60 frames a second.
Hmm.
So I said, why don't they take whatever's on that board and put it in the Silicon Graphics for everybody, you know? It's like, but the idea was that Silicon Graphics sold them this chip because there weren't that many people to spend $75,000 for a computer and $75,000 for the software, but they could sell millions of them that Nintendo would pay them so much per chipset to go into a console. It's funny.
And that was groundbreaking as well. That was a real change for Nintendo.
Also, when they started working with Silicon Graphics, they did things like Donkey Kong Country that were a hybrid. They didn't have everything ready to go for the N64, so they made like a 3D game with the 3D
kind of pre-rendered, wasn't it?
And yeah, pre-rendered on the 2D sprites. Yeah, yeah. So that was the thing. Yeah. So all of that. So yeah. So going to handheld. Now, the other thing that I loved personally about going to handheld was once I was on handheld, I could go to any trade show and walk up to somebody and show them my game.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't need to have a reserved back room and bring in a special PlayStation that's got the right chip in it so it'll play my game that didn't go through the store, you know, and all that stuff, and have to carry stuff around and have them tell me they were too busy and they made all their appointments. You walk up to somebody on the floor, and if he's a gamer, he's going to look at your game. And if it's a good game, he's going to go get his boss.
and also it's standardized as well. You didn't have that problem of, you know, composite and RGB and the
virtual. Oh yeah, yeah. You go in the back room and they got different power than you do and things don't work. Yeah, yeah, all of that stuff.
It all just runs off batteries. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like a thing, and it was a whole different thing. But I think a lot of Nintendo's a nice company, and I don't mean to demean them or anything, but I think a lot of what they did up to the N64 was making bad hardware look better than it was supposed to.
Yeah, they definitely pushed it. Yeah,
they got tricks. Now, where they got their lunch given to them was when the Sega Genesis came along, and they had Sonic spinning. Just the idea of having Sonic and having spin, just flashing those sprites really fast, made him look like he was spinning in a circle. And it was like that. Everybody thought, oh my God, that the computer in that must be so much faster than the other one, you know?
Yeah. And that kind of triggered the whole console wars, which I guess led them to, you know, the N64 as well. So might have been a kind of positive competition, you know?
Now Nintendo fought floppy disks or any kind of medium like that for forever, really. They didn't want to do it because they could control the cartridges.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were people that made them, that made counterfeits of those anyway, you know, and
devices like the Disc Doctor, wasn't there? And these piracy devices.
I had one of them was the Revolution or something. There was one for the GS, for the Nintendo GS, and it allowed us, it was actually better. When I got the cartridge or prototype from Nintendo, it had this thing where you plugged it in the back where the cartridge went, and it stuck out like 10 inches. It's like you're carrying this thing that sticks way out like a ruler. Yeah. And the one that I had, one of those Revolution things, whatever it was, I could just plug it in. It looked like an ordinary cartridge plugged into it. Now, we actually had a purpose for it in that we weren't using it to steal other people's programs. We were using it to put our own on the console. So, but Nintendo stopped them from selling them in the U.S. So then I bought them. I had to buy them from it's near you guys off of the, is it Jersey or something? It's an island.
Yes. Off of yeah, which is a kind of island near France, which is still in Britain.
It's like one of these things where it's a no man's land, like pirates live there or something. Anyway, I had to buy them. And so then I asked them to send them to me, and I didn't get them. I waited like weeks and weeks. And so I said, okay, you better send them again. And so then they sent them.
It's an odd place in computer history, Jersey, as well, because I think Jersey and the Isle of Wight, they had like Apple IIs as well. So there was a kind of maybe something going on there, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. But yeah, so we had a legal purpose, really, of using those for our own work, not for copying other people's games, you know. It was like,
well, yeah. Would they also charge quite highly for like development systems as well, Nintendo? Would they be expensive things?
In the early days, maybe a Super Nintendo was like $15,000 to $30,000.
Wow.
Okay. And you could go buy a Super Nintendo for $180 or something.
Yeah.
So then there was a company up in Oregon. But anyway, they had their own development system. They basically took a cartridge from a game. And they got into the motherboard hardwired so they get the return line, and their emulator plugged into a production Super Nintendo. And the advantage of that was we had a game that crashed on one particular model. We had a tester that took a game home and it crashed when he took it home. It didn't crash for anybody else. And so they said, oh, we'll just chalk it up. It's a bad thing. Don't worry about it. I said, no, we need to get that guy's Super Nintendo. We need to get it in there. So I said, offer him another Super Nintendo and a couple of games.
Well, I think you also teach as well, don't you? You do video game programming.
I did. I kind of cut back a little bit recently. I'm 73. So my wife retired about 5 years ago, and I have more fun making games. I haven't figured out a reason to retire yet, but I take off more time if I want to go somewhere for a weekend and long weekend or whatever. I don't care. But I was teaching first for SMU. They moved me from California here to Dallas in 2003. And it was a premium graduate school for game development at the Guildhall at SMU. And I did that for a short time, like 9 months. And my boss was an idiot. He had a degree in fluid mechanics, a PhD, and he was telling me how to do my games and telling me that he was going to get tenure for all the people that taught there. And then later, so he's giving somebody a tour and he says, oh no, we're never going to get tenure for these people because the field changes too rapidly or something like that. Anyway, it was like, he just told me a week ago, the opposite, you know? And then, so yeah. Anyway, I didn't have much use for him, but he started telling me how to teach my classes, and that's against him.
I was kind of wondering what tips do you give like developers and stuff that they can, you know, take some tips from the early days and kind of apply them to game creation nowadays?
I don't know. You need to understand the hardware really well. And, you know, I had some basics when I was teaching students to do stuff. I'd make them learn binary and hex. I don't care about octal, but because a lot of your hex dumps and stuff, you'd look at a game and it would be in hex, you know, from 0 to 9 and A to F for the digits, you know, and if you don't know enough about hex, if you see 55, say you're expecting 55 and you see AA, you don't know that that's double, that AA is like 10-10 instead of 5-5, you know. Anyway,
teaching that, you know, deep understanding of a system and low level stuff, you know.
Yeah, and then also how to speed up things and how to optimize. How to avoid doing things more than once, how to make a random number generator on a platform that doesn't have one. And sometimes you can hook into something like the vertical blank where you've got something counting and you need a certain number of random things to happen before you do the first thing in a game. Otherwise, every game would start the exact same way. If it doesn't have any human interaction and you just plug the cartridge in and it doesn't have a good random number routine in it or something, it'll do the same move as the first move every time. But on the way into a game, if you're making a guy go through a menu and choose something, while he's doing that, you're seeding the number, you're messing up the number generator and stuff, and you're able to do it. Because it's kind of like one way to make it random is to be blindfolded and grab a spinning wheel. You know, you have the wheel spinning and you grab it on it and wherever you grab, but you see, you can't see where it is. You see, so something like the random number generator is running on the, not just the vertical blank, the horizontal blank is running off of the side there. Where it is, the horizontal position or where it is on a scan line there's a number you can read. And so that if you read that at whatever time you need to, it's going to give you something like a random number, you know, like a number that you'd pick quickly, you know. There's all those kinds of tricks, you know. And
well, also you've kind of designed some games yourself as well, and you've released them on you know, modern platforms and stuff like the Android store and Google as well, and our listeners can check them out at edmagnin.com as well. Can you tell us about some of these titles and some of the kind of differences that you've applied to these games?
Well, you know, I used to do things natively. So the Apple came out with stuff and they had their own stuff. And then later they had Swift was their own programming language. They had all these other things, which are great. But I would do a game natively on a Mac for the Apple. And then I'd have a friend that would do it for the Android. And I watched what he was doing. And he went into Unity, which is a game engine. And he would put he'd look at what I was doing and put that in there. He had the advantage of looking at the source code too. You know, he can look at that and see what I was doing and why I was doing it. So then once he got it into there, then we could release it later on the PC or on other platforms.
Kind of cross platform.
So now we porting, do everything in Unity the first time. And then we, we think we maybe a month and a half to make a good game, and then they're kind of casual games, but we go and we put it on Monday and Tuesday we put it on the handhelds, on the phone and the Android, okay, and then on Wednesday maybe we put on the Apple TV, and then on Thursday we're trying to get on the PC and the Xbox, and so then we So we do like a soft release each of the platforms as we do it. We just kind of send it off to the store. We don't make a big deal about it, but anybody that sees it's there can buy it. And then we put out a press release on the, after we've got the last one done and try to get it out there. So,
and I love that because you're kind of, you're still in development, but you're also kind of just doing it for fun and you're doing it on a new platform and seeing kind of, you know, what people take to.
Yeah, and I don't get to program as much as I used to, but I get to help with the building. So I'm usually building the Apple, the iOS, the Apple TV, and now we can do Mac, because if you've got the new Mac, that has the M1 or M2 chip, it'll play the iPad version of the game on your Mac.
Yeah, I'm running on an M1 at the moment. Absolutely love that chipset. Yeah.
Yeah. But you see, the controls are all different. See, the iPad version was depending on you touching a screen, you know, leaning the screen, you know, but then we get over to the Mac and you're not going to, you know, you're not going to lift tilt your Mac to play the game. So we're using mouse and keyboard and stuff and other things. So yeah. It's kind of fun. You figure out the things. You try to figure out what's going to see. Now we get to do it because it's like indie publishing. We're dealing directly with the stores ourselves. There's no middleman. If we do well, we get a percentage. If we guess wrong and it's something that nobody understood or whatever, but we did some things that I'm really proud of. And some of them were kind of funny. We had one, I don't even know, but I think it's available on one or two platforms. We had one called Call In Sick. And I went to a movie with my wife and I came out and this guy's calling me a fellow podcaster. he says, oh my God, I said, I just played this thing. I need some more information. I want to talk about it. So what it does is it has some background tracks. And it was like, okay, you call up and you say, hey, I'm sorry, I'm stuck in traffic. And it's got the horns honking.
that's just such a smart idea. It's a kind of great excuse to get out of work.
It's not like in the emergency room and everything. So we did this and we put it on all the platforms that we could. And then I wanted to do it. And I tried to get, you know, with all this thing, like you're setting up a call like this and getting the sound to sound right and patching it into this and patching it. So I tried to do it where I was recording the sound and mixing it with my voice live, and that didn't work. I could not get the various platforms to do that very well. But then I remembered all sound is numbers. Okay, it's all digital numbers. it's all sampled. Everything in your computer has been sampled.
Yeah.
So they're numbers. So if you have a tape of the background sound of the traffic and I have a tape of you and I'm recording you talking, I can go through at the same speed and add the numbers together and then make sure they didn't get so loud that they distort it.
I absolutely love this. Like, I'm just looking at it at the moment. It's such a fun idea. Like, there's the hospital one and it's like, I'm in an emergency room waiting to see the doctor. I can't see how long I've been here. I will try and call again. You know, that's such a smart idea, well, really, Freddie and Quirky. We're
taking out of some of the stores because it was deceptive.
Okay, yeah.
And of course it's deceptive. It's a magic trick. I mean, try to explain that to these guys. They got their own rules. And then you've been through a time where people, you know, were maybe deceiving people or doing something. I don't know, whatever it was. So that one had to go. The other one I wanted to do was when the movie Lucy came out.
Yeah.
Remember how smart your brain was and it kept growing speed? Okay. So I talked to somebody. I said, have you done this thing for the thing we wanted to do, like brain meter? And he said, oh, you still want that? And I got mad at the guy. And so I said, no. I had this other guy I was recommending he hire, and I ended up hiring the guy myself and put him on that project. And what we did was we hold the iPhone up to your forehead. And we measure your brain. Let's see. Then I hold it up to my forehead, and it shows that I'm like twice as smart as you are.
I love that. I love that kind of.
It's where you put your finger when you're doing it. The other one was my choice or your choice, and you spin the wheel, and it's like you and your wife can't agree what movie to go to or something. You say, okay, wait, let's spin. Okay, and you always win because if you're holding your thumb on one side of the wheel. You
can kind of rig it. Like,
it goes around a random it goes around a random part time at the end, but stops on the side you want it to stop on.
So, oh, that's absolutely amazing.
That was deceptive too. But you know, there's like a whole category there that we're missing out on. Things like magic tricks and stuff I just love magic when I was
I love that, and I think that's a kind of great use of stuff. And
how do you get that across? They come up with more ways. Every time we fill out a form to put something in the App Store, does it offend the Republic of Korea? Well, I don't know.
I think it's on Google Play still, but I'm sure Apple are a bit strict with that. I do remember there was one that I used to love, which was you download more RAM for your phone. That was one. It's like, that's not going to work. But
all these things are funny. You know, that they're trying to protect everybody from everything, and I don't know. I would recommend, if anybody's interested, they should just get. First of all, if you got people that are hobbyists or trying to make their own games, go ahead and keep doing that. You get some books, do it on your own. You can get Unity is free if you haven't made enough money on it yet. So you can read the requirements online, and you can use Unity to make the game. You can move it to different platforms fairly easily. If you're going to do an iPhone one, you need a Mac to build it on. If you're going to do a Windows one, you need a PC. The Android, you can use either, I think, although we usually do it on the PC. But so you build the thing, and then when you get it in Unity, when it's time to put on a different platform, you change the player settings. And now it's in some ways like a different game, because one of them had a mouse, the other one doesn't. One of them has a touch, one of them has accelerometer, the other one doesn't. By the way, they don't tell you stuff. The Apple TV had one control, where then now it has a different control with a round thing on the top, the touch area on it. Instead of being a postage stamp one, it's now kind of a round one up there. And that no longer has an accelerometer. So we base some of our games on using it like a control, kind of like the controller they had for the Wii, you know, where you're leaning it one way or the other. But people don't like that anyway. I think, and also the phone, we used to do the driving games with the iPhone where you held the accelerometer. And now I think they'd rather have an invisible, like a thumb D-pad on the screen, you know, like, so. That instead, you know, it's like, but having a system where you can get it onto different platforms, you can visualize it, you know, and it has to be fun. It has to be something you make a difference at, you know. A lot of people want to make a game. Very few people have the patience to go all the way through it. You know, that's part of it. Also, working at home, I've worked at home off and on during my career, and I got in fights with companies where they wouldn't let me work at home, and the next company did. And then the one after that made you come in. But I've always done better work on my own. And the guy I work with down in Houston, he's like 4 or 5 hours away by car. We do everything on Skype. We used to get together once a year in San Francisco, but I'm not sure what any of us think San Francisco is that safe anymore. But we go to game conferences and things like that. But it was like, it's you know, getting things that are fun, the people that make a difference. Sometimes you get feedback from people. I got more feedback in the old days when I had that online business because people knew it was me, you know.
Now it's just a kind of app.
I was trying to sell them. So you got a whole other problem, and everybody wants to help you sell your games. And I don't know, when I talk to them, they don't know any more about it than I do. And I don't know very much, you know, and I've been doing. So I'm trying to experiment. I sent out, if you go to Magnet Games on Twitter, you'll see we're promoting the Warp Tunnel challenge. If you're racing in one of these tunnels that twists, and you're trying to get through the thing without hitting the obstacles. And then you go through one level, then you go through the next level, and it keeps, and randomly changes, and you change vehicles and stuff. But it's kind of like the analogy. Willie was the one that kind of designed it. And I said, oh, it's kind of like a forced scroll, you know, that only we're forcing us to move forward in 3D. You don't get the option of stopping, you know.
Yeah.
You go to the right or left to avoid obstacles, but you're still going with the same forward speed. So that was kind of fun. So we're trying this experiment. We put it in Twitter, and I haven't used them for a while. And then I saw people picking on Elon Musk and everything. I was like, okay, fine, so I put it on our site, and I sent it out and got to our 20,000 people that follow us. And then what you do is then you pay them to promote it. And then one day they send it to another 30,000 people, you know.
It's definitely a change from the days when you were doing it on the old modems and kind of on the old phone lines. And I'm going to have to end the interview here because we're running out of time, Ed. But I've really enjoyed talking to you. And
Same here. I'm flattered, you know, with 73. I did retro games before people knew they were retro. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
They were trying to make retro games.
They were cutting edge back then. Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Ed.
Thank you. Appreciate it.